طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this week with an article written by Samer Jaber, who used to co-host This Week in Palestine when he was studying for his master's degree at Brandeis University and the JFK School of Government. He is now back in Palestine as a journalist and doing what he does best, working as an activist against the occupation. Samer wrote a piece on the struggle to find employment in occupied Palestine. Finding work is always a challenge. In Palestine, it is a constant struggle. We no longer have Samer's voice, but we do have his pen. Here is Samer writing on employment in Palestine.
With the inception of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process in 1993, there was an explosion in the number of Palestinian non-governmental organizations operating in the West Bank and Gaza. The proliferation of NGOs, together with the geopolitics of Palestine, made these groups the backbone of Palestinian civil society. Palestinian civil society, in turn, plays an integral part in the self-administering body, the Palestinian Authority, the PA. Despite this proliferation, obtaining jobs in Palestine is a difficult and in some ways a rigged process. Getting a job in Palestine is influenced by four factors. 1. Israel, the occupying power which enacts legislation and enforces the law. 2. International donors, the political and financial sponsors of the peace process between PA and Israel. 3. International organizations which have direct contact with Palestinian civil society and the main relief and service providers. And 4. The PA, which, on the one hand, serves a purpose in carrying out essential tasks, but which also competes with local NGOs for financial resources. These four forces influence civil society by shaping the workforce and the categories of employment in the NGO sector. Local NGOs and international organizations are the major points of entry into paid work in civil society, which is particularly attractive for two main reasons. First, the socio-political influence inherent in this sort of work is free-of-charge service provision. Second, the terms and conditions of employment are considerably better than elsewhere in the public sector. When a job seeker applies for a position with a Palestinian or international NGO, it should be expected that skills and qualifications would be the determining factors in deciding which candidates are successful. And if it is a senior position, leadership qualities should be particularly relevant. However, this does not reflect the reality on the ground. There are three characteristics of Palestinian NGOs that determine the employment matrix. First, Palestinian organizations operate as a family tribal business. The tribal nature of the organization's senior tier is reflected in the compensation of its employees. Second, employment is influenced by sectarian loyalties, resulting in, according to a study conducted by the Lutheran Church, a situation where 60% of Palestinian NGOs are Christian-oriented entities, Thus, church members occupying senior positions make decisions on who is employed, influenced by faith political considerations. Third, although NGOs present themselves as apolitical entities, a wide range of civil society organizations are run as extensions of political parties. A combination of these characteristics is to be found in any Palestinian NGO, regardless of its size, location, date of its establishment, or main field of activity. The pivotal importance of this combination creates a relationship where patronage can be all-important in determining who is successful with job applications and who is not. Thus, background checks on applicants will be carried out with these determinations in mind. Many donor agencies, such as the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, and the British Department for International Development, require local and international NGOs to provide names of their employees who benefit from their money, and no employment decisions are made without confirmation from these agencies. To deal with this situation, many organizations have developed methods of preliminary security screening. At job interviews, for example, where the post requires travel to various locations in the occupied territories, the candidate might be asked if there are any obstacles which might prevent them from moving around. This is a polite way of finding out whether someone is able to obtain travel permits from Israel's civil administration, the branch of the Israel Army which controls the West Bank. Applicants for permits require security screening by the Shabak, Israel's General Security Service. There are no published documents, with the exception of USAID, which describe the parameters of security screening. It is expected that each individual's political affiliation and stance towards the peace process are examined. Some international organizations go further by requiring the job seeker to be demonstrably in favor of the peace process. This would be determined through the job application itself and during an interview. Screening will also examine whether an applicant has ever been imprisoned by the Israeli authorities, particularly if they have been detained since the start of the peace process. If so, the application is likely to be unsuccessful. In contrast, it is said that USAID and other international agencies employ people with military service backgrounds, including some who have served in occupying forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. In their minds, this is standard practice, and local Palestinians are not supposed to question it. Nor is it seen as valid to criticize the donor country's policies, such as those towards Iraq, Afghanistan, or the so-called War on Terror. Criticism of this nature leads to the organizations and or the individual being placed on the donor agency's blacklist. Many international NGOs complain about the screening process operated by donor agencies, yet they do not know the details. Therefore, they try to meet expectations and adopt certain measures to adapt to this situation themselves. Such measures can be described as self-censorship. The U.S., for example, subjects all organizations and individuals receiving aid in the West Bank and Gaza to a specially designed format known as Partners Vetting System, the PVS. At the same time U.S. organizations and citizens are legally exempt from PVS because of U.S. privacy laws. Israel controls all borders and access to internal areas in Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the rest of the West Bank. Palestinian employees need Israeli travel permits, while foreign employees need visas. Israel uses the visa requirements as a measure to delineate acceptable parameters within which these international organizations must work. Sometimes personnel in international organizations bow in an egregious manner to the demands of Israel. It was reported recently that Israel asked senior UN officials in Jerusalem to withdraw a recommendation to place the Israeli military on a list of children's rights violators. The UN officials yielded to the demand. Israel can delay issuing visas and, in some instances, as happened recently with the famous UK-based charity, refuse visa applications until it is satisfied that the staff are acceptable. This creates a situation where organizations use self-censorship to avoid confrontations with Israeli officials and only hire individuals likely to win Israel's favor. This is how Israel and international organizations shape the behavior of Palestinian civil society, by influencing their employment and program policies. I am a graduate of a course of study at the Heller School at Brandeis University, ranked among the top 10 programs in the U.S. I've also taken courses at Harvard's Kennedy School and MIT, two of the highest-ranking universities in the world. I have considerable experience in community organizing and political activism. With these qualifications, skills, and experience, I have sought work with NGOs in Palestine and have applied for more than 300 positions. I have attended dozens of interviews over the past 2 years, but I still cannot get a job with international or local civil society organizations. In the meantime, I have taken part-time teaching positions, provided training about conflict transformation for local community-based organizations, and resorted to freelance writing, such as it is. Three anecdotes for your consideration. Bethlehem University requires applicants to reveal their religion and the sect to which they belong. Failure to do so will disqualify the application. I wrote to the university's vice chancellor, asking him to end this practice, citing its discriminatory and unethical nature, and pointing out that to discriminate by religion is illegal in the United States and the European Union, that provide much of the university's funding. He replied that it was legal according to local laws, and thus acceptable in Palestine. Sometime later, I made the same complaint to two Bethlehem University donors, USAID and the Australian Action Aid. The latter never replied, but USAID eventually sent me a short statement. Quote, "We have reviewed the matter and determined that Bethlehem University is in compliance with local laws," unquote. This clearly shows that donors know the situation and are complicit in cementing the existing employment culture. It also shows how donors abstain from making non-political social change when it does not meet their aims. The second anecdote concerns a conversation with a senior administrator at a well-known UK-based international development charity. He described the selection procedure used by the group. First, individuals who meet the job requirements are selected for an examination. Those who pass are interviewed and the successful candidate is chosen. He assured me that no security screening was used in the process. I applied for a number of jobs with this organization and was once interviewed for a position in a program co-sponsored by DFID. Though I was not asked to take an examination, I was invited to an interview. I mentioned to an employee of the charity that I thought that my political activism had influenced their decision. This was denied, and I was told that no security screening had been involved. I replied saying that it is known DFID screened its beneficiaries, including the employees and programs it supports. The employee terminated the conversation and forwarded me to another person. Finally, on another occasion, at the end of an interview with UN Habitat, I asked the interviewers if the position would be subject to donor security vetting, and whether the fact that I had spent time in an Israeli jail as a political prisoner would affect my application. I was told that it would not. But when I asked again, I directed my question to the DFID representative. He just smiled and abstained from replying. I did not get the job. Job advertisements normally give an outline of the duties of the post and of the kinds of qualifications required, but they do not describe the selection criteria. Many organizations do not mention that a particular post is open only to internal candidates, or that the advertisement is merely required by donor transparency policies, while the hiring decision has already been made. As a result, it is absolutely impossible to know if an applicant has received fair treatment or has enjoyed the same opportunity as any other applicant. This is an issue which concerns everyone trying to find work in the world of NGOs in Palestine. And that was an article written by Samer Jaber, a Palestinian academic, analyst, and activist. The feature presentation this morning is taken from a conference on the Israeli lobby held in April 2015 at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The conference explored the power and influence of the lobby. Over the next several weeks, we will feature some of the voices from this conference, starting today with our own Alice Rothschild, physician, author, and filmmaker, who has personally experienced the Israeli lobby's pushback against criticism of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian people. We include not only her main presentation, but also her response to a couple of questions put to her following her speech. Here is Alice Rothschild speaking at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
Boston-based physician and author and filmmaker and an activist. Dr. Falk mentioned the defamatory tactics, and one defamatory tactic with which we're all familiar is labeling someone an anti-Semite. Another, which has not been used as often as it was maybe 20 years ago, is to label someone a self-hating Jew. Dr. Alice Rothschild is involved in the activities for human rights and social justice in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's an active member of Jewish Voices for Peace, American Jews for a Just Peace, the Workmen's Circle Mideast Working Group, and she has been organizing health and human rights delegations to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza since 2003. Please welcome Dr. Alice Rothschild.
Thank you so much. I just got back from Gaza 3 days ago, if I'm a little verklempt, as we say. So first of all, I want to talk about what silencing looks like. It kind of overlaps with active muzzling, with a strict framing of the dominant paradigm. It involves a widespread systemic intolerance of alternative framing. Silencing challenges free speech, rights of protest. It's all about power, about fear, and about the broad cultural and political assumptions in the world that we live. So I'm going to first speak from my personal experiences as a self-hating Jew, as you mentioned. In 2004, I had come back from the region, and I wanted to do grand rounds, and I was invited to Cambridge Hospital to speak on the impact of war and occupation on civilians. And before my presentation, one of my colleagues came and leafleted the auditorium with these horrific pictures of Jews who'd been blown up by suicide bombers. And after my presentation, he got up and harangued me for 10 minutes, accusing me of lack of compassion for Jews. I wanted to do a similar kind of discussion about healthcare and occupation in my own hospital. I was told by my department chief that I was, quote, a danger to the Jewish people. It took 5 years and his leaving, and I kept trying to do my talk, and finally they said yes. My talk was announced, and they received 100 emails protesting my giving these grand rounds. And I had to take the word occupation outside of the title of my talk, and I was told to stay away from politics. So fast-forwarding the last year and a half, I've been doing a lot of book touring with my two books and my film and doing a lot of presentations. So I've been bumping up against a lot of muzzling. So in the academic setting, I was at American University, and I was talking with students who found that if they focused on human rights, on opposition to occupation, supporting BDS, etc., they found themselves marginalized and accused of bias. They described a campus that was polarized with no conversation between the right and the left. Two professors had been included in the list of professors who are dangerous to Israel, and one untenured faculty member talked about being warned to limit his comments, critical comments about Israel, because it would endanger his future career. At John Carroll University, at a political science class called Peacemaking in the Palestine-Israel Conflict, there were complaints from the local Hillel stating that Jewish students on campus did not, quote, feel safe, having me on campus, and I hit that a lot, that I make students feel unsafe. And they actually had a major meeting of the faculty to determine whether I could be allowed on campus, which I was. And the most disturbing part of that little event was at the end, the Israeli Shalicha, which is an ambassador that the Israeli government sends out to schools and temples and things like that to, you know, do Israel messaging. And she basically came up to me in front of all the people and started screaming at me, attacking me as a liar, doing a great disservice to the Jewish people, and just being a general bully, which was kind of an interesting experience. At the University of Maryland, at an Arab media class, one Jewish student told the professor after I spoke that he was very unhappy with my presentation. He was disappointed in the professor. He accused me of hate speech, and he said he felt offended as a member of Hillel. At the University of Virginia, at a book club, I was doing a book reading, and several alumni complained and took it all the way to the president of the university that I should not be allowed to read from my book, and then threatened to withhold funds since I was allowed. When I've been in more religious institutions, there's a church in our D.C. suburbs that shares a building with a temple. They've had a long positive relationship, and the rabbi told the minister there that if he showed my film, that he would sever their relationship. There was a church in Vermont with a very wonderful pastor who does a lot of work with a progressive except Palestine rabbi who really pushed him hard when he invited me to the church, and I saw the emails, and the tone of the emails were, I'm profoundly disappointed in you, we've worked together on all these issues, I thought I could trust you, and now you are showing this anti-Semitic, one-sided film from this known self-hating Jew. When I try to speak in temples, that's like getting up against the wall of McCarthyism. But I've had a couple of little successes. There was a Reform temple in Ithaca, which I found that whenever they have announcements about speakers like me, the person who does the newsletter puts a little disclaimer saying, this does not represent the opinions of the temple. And I also found as I made my rounds of the few temples that would let me in is that their maps of Israel are all the greater Israel, including all the occupied territory. So that was sort of fascinating to find out. I was invited to an Orthodox synagogue in D.C. by an Orthodox human rights lawyer who's also a Hebrew school teacher there. We set up the film, and the rabbi canceled it. At the greater Jewish community, I was in Sacramento. There's a Jewish Federation newspaper called Jewish Voice. For two times in a row, they've refused to publish an announcement that I'm in town, once doing a book reading, once showing my film, because they say that I am anti-Israel. in a Jewish community in a public library in Ohio. I had this totally conflicted, agonized audience. They were completely unaware of the many millions of dollars that are being spent on Israeli Hasbara and the aggressive control of Israel messaging. And one woman got up and she said, "We could have this open conversation anywhere in the United States, but in Arab countries, we would be censored, arrested, and sold into sex slavery." I pointed out that actually I cannot have this conversation anywhere in the United States. In fact, I can't have this conversation in most temples, hillels, and Jewish community centers. She then pointed out that the poster for my talk was very offensive because it had the word conflict in it and a picture of the separation wall. So she said, "It says what side you're on." The most disturbing point in this very interesting public library came at the end when a little old lady comes up to the poor woman who's selling my books and announced in a very loud voice that my book should be burned, at which point a gentleman standing behind her said, "That's what they did in Nazi Germany." And last February, I was leaving New York City, and I saw this huge billboard, I don't know if you've seen it, that says, "New York Times against Israel, all rant, all slant, stop the bias." This is sponsored by the wonderfully well-funded and ironically misnamed Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. So silencing can be both active, and it also comes through how we frame the issues and the language and what are the assumptions behind it. So going back to that temple in Ithaca, one of the machers in the Jewish community challenged me on my maps, and she basically said, you know, the Arabs were the migrants, and as she said, the last independent indigenous nation was 2,000 years ago, and she referred me to a right-wing blog for accurate information. I was at World Fellowship in New Hampshire, which is a wonderful family camp for progressives, and a woman in the audience told me this amazing story. Her child was attending public school in the New York City school system, and they were studying indigenous peoples. And as an example, the teacher stated that the Jews were the indigenous people and the Palestinians were treating them badly. So the daughter, being her daughter, piped up and she said, no, it's really, you know, the other way around. And the girl was sent out of class to the principal's office. Her parents were called in and they were given a stern warning about that kind of talk. And when the mother agreed with the daughter, the principal actually said that that version of history is not allowed in the New York City school system. And just recently I got this award from my town in Brookline for social justice work on Israel-Palestine, and both of the elected officials in the Massachusetts legislature boycotted the event. They're usually presenting the awards, and one funder pulled out. So that's what you see in your community. If we look at the issue of framing and language, you know, the framing is the Jews are good, the Arabs are bad, and you think about the visuals. You know, in our newspapers, there's a tendency towards the sympathetic Jewish settler mother crying over her injured child and the young man wrapped in a keffiyeh throwing a rock. That's the two visuals you see. And so there's an emotional message in our media that rarely portrays Palestinians as fellow human beings who may actually have some incredibly legitimate grievances and who actually are rarely violent. So Palestinians are never seen as the most educated group in the Arab world. They're never seen as the people with a long tradition of nonviolent resistance. You just don't see that. And so the question is, why is history that? Because history in our world is really a creation of groupthink. And if you go back in history, for decades, Palestinian history, trauma, aspirations, rights have been really invisible in Western discourse. I think it's partly a reflection of our own racism towards Arabs, our Islamophobia, guilt about the Holocaust, and manipulation by Zionist leaders, and then we add in cultural, economic, and military imperialism. So how far does this go back? Well, there was early silencing of the Palestinian experience by U.S. Zionists in the 1940s and the 1950s. So even back then, you would be viciously attacked if you criticized the partition plan, if you criticized Jewish nationalism and all that kind of stuff, or you mentioned that there was a Palestinian tragedy. And so journalists were accused of anti-Semitism. They were threatened. Politicians were threatened with loss of financial support. I mean, this goes way back to the founding of Israel. And then, as was mentioned, in 1974, the Anti-Defamation League officially defined what they called the new anti-Semitism anti-Semitism as criticism of Israel. And 10 years later, AIPAC issued this college guide exposing the, quote, anti-Israel campaign on campus, which they still think is going on, and basically was trying to tell students why they shouldn't listen to people who are critical of Israel because they're all obviously foreign terrorists and anti-Semitic. So you see this kind of McCarthyism crept into Jewish institutions, and the epithet of anti-Semitism has been used ever since to silence and demonize critical voices. The Israelis joined in the fray with the Herzliya Conference in 2010, where they had a whole session on winning the battle of the narrative, and it's all about rebranding. It's a PR problem. And then a year later, the Rout Institute in Tel Aviv, it's a think tank, issued a position paper laying out the strategy of, quote, naming and shaming those on the left who are critical of various things. And the important thing is that they identified a strategy to engage Jewish institutions and individuals, to identify and marginalize groups, to separate medium-sized liberals from more critical liberals, and to create this Israeli brand. And you also see at that point the word, the people, they go against people who are delegitimizing Israel. So that's another word that comes up. So what's happening now is a direct result of those kinds of policy decisions. People talk about shielding Israel from the abuse of human rights law. And then in 2011, Haaretz reported that there was actually an Israeli military intelligence unit that was created to monitor folks like us. So in academia, we have Hillel International, which is the umbrella organization for the Hillel chapters on American campuses. It did start out not as a Zionist organization, but it's basically become an Israel advocacy organization. And despite, espousing pluralism and tolerance, they actually have very strict guidelines about what you're allowed to talk about and what kind of speakers you're allowed to have. And in December of 2014, Hillel International and the Simon Wiesenthal Center developed a new campus surveillance tool, which is a phone app, to fight anti-Semitism, which will be deployed on 550 U.S. campuses with Hillel centers. And it's supposed to report students and professors who are being anti-Semitic, and they call it See It and Report It. The Anti-Defamation League last December also published a blacklist of those who have linked what's going on in Ferguson with what's going on in Palestine. And also, as was mentioned, there have been more than 6,000 U.S. police trained in Israeli police and military units, and this is funded by the ADL. It's also funded by JINSA, which is another group to watch, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And you may not know that the New York City Police Department now has a branch in Tel Aviv. So we now have our police emulating the Israeli Defense Forces. We have academics being monitored and attacked. We have university donors pressuring administrators. We have groups sympathetic to Palestinians being confronted with lies. And I suggest you Google Hamas on campus. It's a really interesting YouTube. And then people are emotionally blacklisted and, called anti-Semitic. Now, in the Jewish community, there's actually a tremendous conflict because Jews have traditionally been more left-wing on every other right but Palestine. And many of us, particularly people under 35, which obviously doesn't include me, feel that we are being asked to suspend our love of justice, democracy, and fighting for the oppressed when it comes to Israel-Palestine. And we see very right-wing forces, Campus Watch, Stand With Us, CAMRA, AIPAC, David Project, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, aligned with the Christian right, lobbying Congress to support the most right-wing governments in Israel. I call this our own U.S. branch of the Likud. And then we have muzzling of dissent and tolerance in our own community. So these assumptions are reinforced. The Jews are the good people, Arabs are the bad people, Jews are like us, they're white people creating a Western-style state in a savage, untamed region of the world. So after 67, there was this move towards making uncritical support of Israel the cornerstone of being a good Jew. And so being a Jew and a Zionist are now merged, and Israel is the religion. Christian Zionists marched up and embraced the idea we all got to return so we can have an apocalypse, so they embraced the settler movement. Liberal Christians then bought the mythology. The U.S. government developed our huge military-industrial complex. And with this framing, the history and trauma and aspirations of Palestinians becomes more and more invisible. So this manipulation happens by controlling the message. And how is that done? We have birthright trips, which are basically brainwashing. We have students that have been recruited, and I've heard paid, to use social media to compliment Israel. They call this public diplomacy. There are a ton of free junkets for all kinds of people, ranging from academics to food and wine critics to go to Israel. We have all the academic collaborations. We have our Israeli ambassadors in all sorts of Jewish settings enforcing what the message is. And so there is this multi-million dollar industry to brand Israel with pinkwashing, greenwashing, faith washing, all those kind of things. The good news is that there is pushback. There is a lot of pushback towards greenwashing and pinkwashing and faithwashing, and if you don't know what it is, just ask me. And there's also pushback within the Jewish community. We are not monolithic. More than 50% of Jews in America, particularly those under 35, have no interest in Israel or feel some sympathy for Palestinians. And the interesting thing for me as a, you know, confirmed secular Jew is that many groups are questioning all of this framing using Jewish values and doing it in the name of Jewish religion. So I have young students telling me Zionism has hijacked Judaism. And we keep mentioning Jewish Voice for Peace. This is an example of the growth of one of those kinds of groups. We tripled in size during the Gaza War. A group called If Not Now came out during the Gaza War, demanding the Jewish communal organizations recognize the Gaza dead. We have the Open Hillel movement, which is demanding that Hillels do not monitor and have these red lines, and these kids are having these conferences, breaking all the rules, talking about BDS in Hillels, and that actually did happen just in February at Harvard. Three civil rights leaders from the 60s got up and talked about BDS at Harvard Hillel, and we all were very happy. The other thing that you're seeing is what I call an increase in intersectionality, so that there are unified coalitions forming between students of color, Muslim students from colonized countries, queer and trans students, feminists, all seeing the links between the oppressions of Palestinians and their own oppressions. So in conclusion, because I'm going to get this in 18 minutes, what is happening to Jews and their allies is a loud battle about the meaning and understanding of history. We're separating Judaism, the religion, from Zionism, the national political movement. We are making a call to define a Jew as someone grounded in religion or culture or history, a set of ethics, a sense of peoplehood. And all these definitions are equally compelling. It does not matter if you're in the diaspora, you know, because Israeli Jews think us diaspora Jews are not really first-rate Jews. And so diaspora Jews are really reclaiming our legitimacy and our voice as Jews. There's a delineation of the racist ideology of anti-Semitism from thoughtful moral criticism of the policies of the country of Israel, and the treatment and solidarity of Palestinians has now become the civil rights movement of our day. We see major challenges such as the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, the campus Open Hillel, Students for Justice in Palestine, etc. We have African American civil rights leaders embracing this issue and drawing parallels with our civil rights struggles. And with all of the increased amount of information that we now have access to, you really can't hide reality anymore. And I would like to propose that the intensity of the backlash and the muzzling may also reflect that the mainstream and right-wing forces are feeling increasingly cornered. Their positions are less defensible, and perhaps this is the beginning of a major turning point in the long struggle for justice in Israel-Palestine. Thank you.
Dr. Alice Rothschild.
The first question is, what is anti-Semitism, which is a fabulous question, and how does it relate to Zionism? So let me give you the two-minute answer to something that people write PhD theses on. The way I define anti-Semitism is hating Jews because they are Jews, and that's the only the main reason to hate them or the organization they're in or whatever. So how does Zionism mesh with being Jewish? So if you look historically at Zionism for, you know, a kabillion years, there was sort of a religious Zionism, the Zionism of my Orthodox grandfather. It was a messianic sometime, some, you know, who knows when the Messiah will come. And it was that kind of religious, mythical Zionism. It wasn't actually meant to, that something would actually happen in the near future. And then in the late 1800s with Herzl and the First Zionist Congress, there was an increasing movement amongst Eastern European intellectuals to respond to the horrific amount of Christian anti-Semitism that occurred in Europe. And they, along with all sorts of other groups that were having movements of nationalism, so it's in that context of nationalism, and also in the context of colonialism, developed the idea that the Jews needed an actual place to go to be safe. They were kind of vaguely helped by the British Empire that promised the same piece of land to the Arabs and the Jews. And I think one of the things to remember is that Lord Balfour, with the Balfour Declaration, had Christian Zionist tendencies. So there were a lot of sort of anti-Semitic reasons why colonial powers wanted to get rid of their Jews and put them someplace else. There was actually a tremendous debate within the Jewish intellectual community. I put Martin Buber on one side and Herzl on the other. You know, should there be an actual place? Should it be in Uganda? Should it be in Palestine? Should it be a binational state? Should it be a Jewish-only state? I mean, this was a major, major debate, and I think it's important to understand that. The people who wanted a Jewish-only state won out, and sort of the rest is history. So at this point, when I use the word Zionism, I'm referring to a political Zionism as it is currently practiced. And the way I define it as currently practiced is a belief that Jews, for either historical, Holocaust, biblical, whatever reasons, deserve or must have a state that is for Jews and that privileges Jewish people over everybody else. And that is what's going on in Israel right now and in the occupied territories. So the reason that I think it is really important to separate Jews from Zionists is that, first of all, many Jews are not Zionists. Zionism is a political movement that I think, in retrospect, has had really catastrophic implications, both to non-Jews and to Jews. And I would argue that political Zionism, as it is now practiced, is incredibly dangerous to Jews. So that creating, you know, when I look at the state of Israel and I look at the policies of the state of Israel, I can't find anything Jewish about it except singing Hatikva in Hebrew. I mean, seriously. And when I, you know, I'm at a checkpoint and there's some 20-year-old pointing a big gun at me and, you know, accusing all the civilian Palestinian women that I'm surrounded by of something, this is not Jewish. This is not Jewish values. It is not Jewish history. It's just not related to any of my understanding of what it means to be a Jew. So I put that under Zionism and under political Zionism and under occupation and under oppressing some other peoples because they're not Jewish. And even in the state of Israel, 20% of the citizens are Palestinians, and they are second-class citizens. They get less of everything. And so for me, founding a state that by definition privileges Jews over everybody else is doomed to chronic catastrophe and ultimately to failure. And I think that's very different than Jews as a religion or an ethnicity or as a culture. So that's why I keep those very, very separate. Okay, so I'm being asked, what is the New York Police Department doing in Israel? And there are no blacks there to kill except the Ethiopian Jews. So first of all, that's not quite correct. There are Sudanese and Eritrean asylum seekers who are black who are subjected to horrific amount of racism, so there are blacks to kill. But that's not the answer. So the thing that you need to understand is that what sort of the Israeli PR is that one of their biggest products is security. And that they really know how to do crowd control. I mean, they've been occupying a whole ton of people for decades now, and so they have the expertise to do crowd control and to fight terrorism. And when you sort of investigate this a little bit, not only do they have the most advanced weaponry, mostly from us, but they have developed a huge system of collaborators and sort of a malicious kind of security system to keep a population under control. So what our American cities want to do is to learn how to control us. They want to learn how to control protests and crowds. They want to learn how to fight, quote, terrorism, as it is getting more and more broadly defined. And Israel is supposed to have the best product. So that's what our policemen are doing in Israel. The other thing that is very, very worrisome, I think, is, for instance, if you look at the wall between the U.S. and Mexico, that is partly built by an Israeli company because they're also really good at building walls to keep people out or in or whatever they're doing. So, and the thing that gets even more messy about this whole thing is that our U.S. military now has all this excess equipment now that we're not actively killing a whole bunch of people, we're just kind of doing it more slowly. So the military is now giving our police departments tanks and, you know, things you might need to do if you're doing traffic in Idaho or something. So we have a police that are weaponized by our excess military equipment that are trained in Israel, and that means that we are all at risk. So I always like to remind people that this is not some, you know, little conflict off in some crazy country. This is going to come to bite us. The reason that we have our Fergusons and all the black men that are just assassinated, shoot to kill, is for a reason. And these are the kind of forces that go into making that true in our society.
That was Alice Rothschild speaking at a conference on the Israeli lobby at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. last April. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.